Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and ask it about its mother. My name is Sam Donnewald and my co-host this week is John Harper. If you're here, you probably know who John is, or at least know their work. Dice Exploder alone has done episodes on three of their games: Lasers and Feelings, Blades in the Dark, Agon 2nd Edition, co-designed by Sean Nittner, and I'm sure someone will eventually bring on Lady Blackbird. And these are big games. Blades has a freaking TV show in development. It is not a stretch to say that John is among the most influential designers in tabletop RPGs ever. Needless to say, it's nice to have them on the show. John brought in a fairly complex dice resolution mechanic. The risk sheet from Psyrun by Michael Lingner and Christopher Moore, and then later published by McGay Baker and based on the mechanical idea of other kind dice by McGay and Vincent Baker. Psyrun's risk sheet is such an elegant piece of design, packing essentially a whole game onto a single sheet of paper. It's also pretty visual. I think we do a decent job describing it in the show, but if you haven't had the pleasure of looking at it, there's a link in the show notes, and glancing at it for like 10 seconds even before John and I start talking will probably make our conversation a lot easier to follow. We talk about this as the episode goes on, but I think this mechanic is an especially good one to study if you're a new designer, or even just trying to get back in touch with the basics of design. It's simple to understand, it's obvious how you might hack it, and it's just so cleanly functional. And I just selfishly love to see more other kind games out there. All right, with that, let's get into it. Here is John Harper with Psyrun's risk sheet. John, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I am a fan of the show, and it's cool to actually be on it now.
Yeah, obviously, big fan of yours also, given how many of your silly games I have covered on this silly show. So what are we talking about today?
Today, we are talking about the risk sheet mechanic from a game called Psyrun by McGay Baker, and it is an evolution of an older mechanic called Other Kind Dice, which people may have heard of. Actually, the first version is from 2003. I just confirmed from Vincent Baker's old blog. So it's its 20th year now for this dice mechanic to exist. This iteration of it is for the game Psyrun, which is a game about superpowered people that have escaped from some sort of sinister organization and are on the run trying to break free of these chasers that are coming to recapture them. And in the process, they have sort of amnesia and they're revealing memories of their past and trying to put together who they are and what they need to be doing. Kind of a fast one-shot type of game.
I've played it a couple of times and it's remarkable how intuitive it is and how much this, I mean, we should get into the risk sheet before I start commenting on the risk sheet. Do you want to like describe what the central mechanic of this game is, like what the risk sheet looks like?
It's great for radio. I picked the mechanic that requires visuals.
We did a whole episode on character sheets I recorded yesterday. So listen, it was a fun time doing that. But yeah.
Yeah. So the risk sheet, it's shared by the group. So you print one out or you have one on your virtual tabletop or whatever. And it has 8 boxes on it that describe different types of goals and consequences that characters are going to be facing. And then each of those boxes has a range of outcomes for a D6. So like, for example, the goal box on the sheet just asks the question, do I achieve my goal? And if the die is a 4, 5, or 6, you do achieve your goal. And the GM has first say. We'll get into the first say thing in a minute. And if you put a 1, 2, or 3 on the box, you fail the goal and the player has first say. So the idea here is you have these boxes with goals, risks, you know, impairment, harm, chasers. You roll a pool of dice and then assign those numbers after the roll to the different boxes. So the classic example would be like, I want to use my powers to lift this wreckage off this trapped person. And the danger might be that they suffer harm. So if I roll a high die and a low die, I can decide like, oh, I want to make sure they're not hurt, but I don't get the rubble off them. Or I do get the rubble off them, but they get hurt. If you have 2 low dice, obviously it's bad. If you have 2 high dice, it's good. So it's the classic success with consequences kind of thing that we are familiar with very much so now in PBTA style games and others. But this was one of the earliest in that era of design in the early 2000s to really bring that to the fore and give the player a lot of control over it. And modern forms in Forge in the Dark and PBTA,
yeah,
there's a little bit more of a gambling feel where you're rolling and you get what you get and you just hope for the best. This mechanic, because you're rolling this pool of dice, usually four or more, you can kind of have this feeling of safety a little bit where you can be like, okay, well, even if this goes really bad, if I just get at least one, four, or five or something, I can put it in the thing that I really don't want to happen or the thing I really do want to happen.
I find this approach so compelling relative to the standard PBTA 7-9 partial success kind of range thing, because first of all, I feel like this puts a ton of choice in the hands of the player rather than the character. And like sometimes it's, you can kind of then filter that down into the character making a choice of like, oh, I can feel that if I push on this rubble, they're going to get injured even if I rescue them and I like pull back and don't do that. But really, like, you as a player are basically min-maxing your role. And I think like making hard choices is sort of the fundamental unit of role-playing games. Like, I think that is the most interesting thing you can be doing in these games. And this just makes every role, not just one, but a bunch of hard choices. Like, what are you doing with all these dice?
Yeah, and it can incentivize the getting into trouble, because if you do have the risk of harm, it adds a die to your die pool. Now, you're going to have to assign something to that after you roll, but it gives you more choices, more potential to get that six to put in your goal. So the more in danger you get, the better you are at achieving your goals, even though you're going to likely suffer some harm or consequences. And that's kind of, I mean, the Devil's Bargain die in Blades in the Dark is a long descendant of that kind of thing.
Totally.
You are getting a bonus die in exchange for this consequence. But this formulation of it, because you have that sheet of menu options to place them in, it is that after the fact decision making. Like you said, it puts that control in the player's hands, which can be really empowering. It's great for something like Siren, especially because you are super powered people. You're not superheroes necessarily. However, there is a sort of hidden stinger to the game where if you play this system for a while, you'll notice characters get really chewed up because you're always in that position of having to put a die in one of those consequence boxes. And if you do that, you know, five or six times in a one shot, it's a little dicey, but you're probably going to pull through. But after four sessions of that, your characters get all chewed up. So games that have used this system that weren't one shot oriented, it works better if the game is a type where characters are supposed to be sort of ground down. And yeah,
my brand. Yeah, there's an interesting thing in there where you're saying like, hey, if you put harm on the line, you get another die to roll, and you're gonna have to put something in harm, but you know, you're gonna have a higher chance of achieving the thing that you want to achieve. But that also opens up a lower tail on the possible results too, because the more dice you're rolling, like if you just roll only terrible results, the more stuff you have at risk, you're really fucked at a certain point.
Yeah,
like, you can get just so far into the hole in like a single roll with this game.
You can. And there's a fun little mini game component too, because the boxes, they don't all have the same range of result.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them might have a result for each number, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's six different outcomes depending on the die you put. One, like the goal, it's just four or higher is good and three or lower is bad. So you have these situations sometimes where you look at your array of dice and you go, ooh, a three is usually bad, but it's actually not so bad on this box. So I can put the three there and sort of avoid this thing that would have been worse, which can be fun to do as long as the range of choices is limited. If the sheet was 20 boxes, it would be overwhelming. But the way Siren works is generally you have just a few things to choose from by default when your character is doing something risky. But then you add stuff in as the fiction demands. You know, if the chasers are going to get closer, you add that as a box you need to deal with, and you get a die for that. Harm is a factor, you get a die for that. If you use your psychic powers, you get a die for that, which is always, do they go out of control? Which is another kind of thematic component here. It's not like, does it work? Does my power function? You know, it's more about, does it cause unintended consequences?
It fits the mechanic well. I mean, as we've kind of been saying, like other kind of dice are so much about collateral damage of various kinds, I think, whether that's to you or to other people. Those sort of partial success consequences is, that's what the mechanic is. I don't know. I'm just stating the opposite.
Yeah. Because of that ratcheting component, the chasers are going to get closer. You are going to suffer some harm. Your powers probably are going to go out of control. The other box we haven't talked about is the reveal box, which is characters have these unanswered questions that you come up with during character creation. And when the reveal box is in play, you put a die there and you or the GM or someone gets to answer one of those questions with a flashback or with a memory that comes to you or something. Those can be really powerful in terms of driving the story forward too. It's not just the chasers that are getting closer. There's a little track that you use in the game where the chasers are sort of like a number of scenes behind you. And we flash back to them like doing DNA analysis and like doing a portrayal and stuff. So there's that component where you see them visually like moving ever closer to the scene you're in for a confrontation. But the reveal thing also is a big driver because whenever I've run it, like somebody will realize they have some sort of relationship in the world. You know, they have a lover or a parent or a child or something. And all of a sudden they're like, we have to go to Minnesota.
Yeah.
Like, I got to find my mom. I just remembered, you know, and that can just veer the story. And the game really makes that easy. It's very easy to just move the characters to a new location, doing a new thing, pursuing a new goal. And those dice outcomes, you're always going to get something when you roll on one of those, the chasers or the reveal or your powers going haywire. That's going to make the narrative really drive.
I think the reveal box in particular is something we should spend more time on because I think it does everything that you were describing. But my friends who have had trouble with this game really cite the reveal box as the reason why, that because the 1-3 on it just says runner has no memory triggered, GM has first say, it becomes basically a dump box. Like if you roll mediocrely and you're not invested in the long-term story, or you really want to make sure that this moment doesn't spiral completely out of control for you, you just put one of your failures there and nothing really bad happens. But because it's such a good dump, but also because it's like recovering memories is both the most fun way to kind of drive the story forward emotionally in my experience, and also the way that the game mechanically like proceeds towards its end. I've had a couple of friends end up in games where people just kind of focus on the moment and never get to that memory stuff and never quite get the emotional investment that like that card would bring. I have not personally had that experience, but I know I had someone just say like, hey, I'm going to just turn that 1-3 into like another psychic powers go wild or like something bad happens to me in the moment. Just cranial brain pressure increases. And if you do that 5 times, your head explodes. Like we'll put that on the 1-3. Mm. And I think that something like that would be interesting there, but it's also nice to have kind of a dump card. So I feel a lot of different ways about it.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts about that. One is there is a bit of a social contract element here where when we agree to play Psyrun, we agree to play these people with missing memories that want to recover them. So if you don't engage with that and like purposely avoid it, that is going to cause problems. You know, it won't necessarily automatically be that way because you don't always have the freedom to put a low die there. You might not have any low dice. So it's going to happen. And when one player character answers their questions, that triggers the end game mechanically. You obviously you can end the game session whenever you want, but that's the mechanical trigger for it. So I would not like be a dick about it, but like, I think, you know, if I was playing with someone who like was like, no, I don't want to do that, I'm going to avoid revealing my questions, I'd be like, well, you know, this is maybe not going to be a fun game for you.
Yeah, totally.
But having said that, I think the idea of having a punchier consequence on that 1-3 there is totally, it's not a bad idea at all. And the game does kind of give you a space there. It says on a 1-3, the GM has first say for the reveal and describes confusion, frustration, or a lack of connection that results. So there is some room there to not just have a nothing happens outcome. If you put your 2 in reveal, I think the GM's within their right to say, like, you lose track of that agent for a moment and you're lost in this reverie that doesn't lead you anywhere. And the next thing you know, they're behind you with their gun at your back or whatever.
Yeah,
I think that's fair to do. You know, again, like you don't want to be too punishing for something that's supposed to potentially be a place to put a low die.
Yeah. And I have historically played with a lot of people who are like, you're telling me that with my single success, I can get a little bit of character development and have myself fail on all other regards. That sounds like a party. Like I'm completely in. Like I really want to do that. And it's nice to be able to do that. But you know, I recorded this episode with Alex Roberts about a mechanic that sort of is naming a negative space. And we talked a lot about how when you just kind of leave something empty in a game, that's a little bit of a missed opportunity. And on the one hand, I like that there's a card that is a little bit of a dump to give people a little bit of a break because this game can be so harrowing and so full of consequences. But I do feel like there's an opportunity there to put in something explicit about the GM, like hinting at a memory for you or something to kind of like push that forward. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that would be a perfectly good little hack there because yeah, it does, things can fall apart. The chase component turns into captured when the chasers show up, which of course is another narrative thing. Like somebody gets captured, we have to rescue them. But then there's a do I disappear forever outcome that gets brought in after that. Huh. And it's just yes or no, like, yep, they disappear forever. Bye. Again, kind of playing into that one shot vibe where things can be very consequential and have high stakes. So yeah, I think with a group of players that are interested in revealing their characters' memories and having a little bit of a release valve, pressure valve there on the reveal, I think it works well.
I mean, off that, do we want to talk about first say at this point?
Yeah.
So the first say, just to be really clear what we're talking about here, like the goal card says, as we said before, 4-6, runner achieves goal, GM has first say. 1-3, runner fails goal, player has first say. And just in plain English, the thing that I interpret from that is, hey, this is the person who's going to like take point on describing what happens next, but then we're going to open up a conversation about that. But Vincent Baker published a long blog post about Other Kind Dice, sort of an Other Kind SRD a while back. And I know reading it that first say sort of maybe had broader connotations within the design community at the time, or like was opposed to games that were giving people last say or final say. I'm curious if you can talk about that.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion in the early 2000s around narration rights, kind of. It turned out not to be very fruitful, really. It was, the conversation was fruitful, and several games at that time took that idea very seriously and mechanically parsed it out, trying to tease out this power dynamic between like very strongly GM'd games, who has the authority to say what's true in the fiction, and you know, all that stuff was kind of unsaid in designs before that, or very tightly constrained in different ways. So people had this notion that, well, you could like parcel it out somehow where because I mechanically did a thing, I got this 6 or I spent my token, I get to say that the schoolhouse burned down or whatever. And that exploration, it produced some interesting experiments. And I think it kind of showed how those assumptions are unspoken largely in a lot of other designs. But really, finally, mechanically parsing out like narration, who gets to say what when, kind of ended up being a little bit of a dead end because it was too mechanized for that. It felt too tightly constrained. So this is a little bit of a product of several years of that conversation and taking a stab at a different way of doing it instead of saying that you may speak now. You're the one who gets just to decide what's true and everyone listens. This was a way of turning away from that and saying, well, what we really need is like a way to kick this off and like give someone a prompt and say, hey, why don't you describe the thing first? And there is still a little bit of a power thing going on there because the person who leads, they're giving everyone else something to work with and they're making, you know, it's a strong choice. It's like an improv game. You know, your first person to talk is going to establish a lot. But then the other person who wraps it up has a lot to say, too, in how that all resolves. So it's more of a way with this development in Other Kind Dice and Siron, a way of just kind of helping people say the stuff that needs to be said to resolve it, as opposed to that really like authority passing kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's really starting a conversation instead of ending one feels so much kinder and like the point of playing role-playing games. Like I want to tell a story with my friends. I don't want someone to like dictate a story to me necessarily. And even as you're saying, someone's got to start and I like knowing who that person is going to be. But I want everyone to have a chance to be like, I don't like that content, or, oh, what about this cool idea? Like the best stuff is always people like riffing on each other. And if you're shutting down a conversation as opposed to opening one up, you're going to miss a lot of that.
Yeah. And I think Meg even says here, when you have first say, your first say can be, oh, gee, I don't know. Yeah. Sam, do you have an idea for this?
Yeah.
that's also having first say. And it's an opening of that door. Someone's got to do it. And the game is sort of nudging us in that direction. And also, like, we're in the same category here. We want to see our characters maybe get beat up a bunch and go through the ringer a lot. And there are those times, especially when you're suffering, having first say is I really want to be like, and then he throws me through the window, you know, and that's really fun for me. So it's even juicier to have that first stab at it when it's your own character that's being harmed or whatever.
Yeah, it's cool to see on the harm card, the one result is runner is dying, player has first say. That like when you are most in trouble, the game looks at you and says, this is your moment. You're dying. It's your person who's dying. You should have the right to sort of begin the end of your character's story here, or like, you know, be a voice of authority in this moment, even if this horrible thing is happening to you.
Yeah, and that's a card that has many results. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then a 5, 6. So it really is just a one that is like the worst.
Yeah, if you're pretty beat up, the GM has first say. But if you're like dying, then you get first say back again, right? Like,
yeah, it's, I like the way harm works here too, because it's when you just suffer harm without fatal harm or whatever, it just means that before you rolled, you put one of your dice on the impaired section. But then if you get hurt again, after you roll, you have to put your highest die there. So again, it like, it raises those stakes. It pushes the game towards its finale. It's in a kind of soft way, strangely. You're not having to calculate a bunch of stuff. It's not.
It's clean. It's so clean. I love it. Just, it feels like such a natural part of the system. It is such a clear result of what might happen when you are hurt, and so easy and intuitive to implement. It's a really nice little piece of design.
Yeah, it's like a little visual aid reminder. You know, people who've played Blades, for instance, where its harm is also, you know, kind of narrative. I think we've all played those sessions where an hour into it, someone goes, oh man, I was supposed to be taking a die penalty this whole time. I forgot.
Yeah.
This is just because everyone's sharing this sheet together. It's very easy to just put your die out and you know, like, okay, I have one fewer and it's just going to sit there, prompting everyone else to be aware of that and help remember to do it. And also get that sense when three of the four players have dice in the impaired box and maybe you see like, I have the blue dice, you have the red ones, whatever. We're like, oh boy, things are tough.
There's something so cool about how Siron really has, it has a couple of other subsystems like beyond this risk sheet, but 90% of the game is just the risk sheet. Like so much of the game is just this. That's part of the reason that I'm out here forgetting harm and blades like all the time, is because, you know, there's like four or five different systems going on in the middle of a score, or like little appendages of stuff. And I obviously love Blades. I love the way it plays, but it's also keeping track of all those things distracts from the main system. And when you can make harm like a core part of the main system visually right there on the same sheet along with everything else, like it basically works the same.
Yeah. I always recommend this for people who want to introduce people to the hobby for the first time. Mm. If they have any interest in the supporting fiction, X-Men-esque or X-Files or whatever you want to flavor it as, because almost everything is that sheet. Your character sheet even hardly has anything on it. Your questions mainly. Because of that amnesia component and the ambiguous nature of what's happening at the beginning, they don't have to be brought up to speed on a bunch of lore and where the dwarves came from or whatever. It's just very, very fast to get up and running. And then the physicality of having that sheet there, they've learned like basically the whole system after one roll. And especially now, there's a category of board games called roll and write games, where you roll a pool of dice and then assign them to different aspects of the board game. And people who have familiarity with those games, which are fairly popular, I think, in the board game space, it's another easy way to say, hey, you know, roll and write games, this is like that, but it's storytelling.
you're gonna write a little story, though, not a little like railroad. Yeah.
Sanguis populi, the blood of the people, the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth, deep within the illusory forest, familiar with death as they have eluded it. They are called upon for a desperate task, slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy, being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies, and none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great, pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You couldn't have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow. A tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to Tale Is Yet Told wherever you get your podcasts.
The great thing about this, too, is it is very easy to hack. Like, just now, yeah. You came up with, like, two different ways to make that card sing better at a given table with just a moment's thought. And
totally.
All of the result boxes are like that. You could tweak them and say, oh, I want to make the goal 5-6, you get it, and 4-less, you don't. Or I want to tweak this or that, or it change this word or change that word. And it does a lot of work in play just by making little tiny changes like that. It's easy to see how that hack is impacting play.
It's a beautiful piece of design for implying all of that so easily. Like, the fact that there are so many different ranges on these cards is, on the one hand, just kind of cool, and it provides the sort of moment of feeling like you're getting away with something by, like, putting a 3 on a card where a 3-4 is a partial success, as opposed to putting that 3 on the goal where it's a failure. Mm-hmm. But also, so many different ranges implies exactly the thing that you're saying. You can change these ranges. And the chase card turning into capture, turning into disappear, is implying this idea of, what if you had linked cards? What if you swapped one card out for another? Like, what if you changed the harm card so it started as, like, a glancing thing and became a, like, mortal wound thing? Like, you can immediately start seeing how to take this thing apart and push on its edges and do other things with it, just in the visual layout, even. It's incredible.
Yeah, I often recommend it to new designers as a thing to hack and just, you know, get it to the table and play and hack at least a couple times to get the sense of doing that, because this rewards that in a very immediate way. And like you said, you can just immediately see, well, ooh, what if we had archetype cards? So like, I'm the tough one and you're the fast one or whatever. So I have a card that I can put dice on that's unique to my character. You know, it's stuff like that. It's very easy to see the space and implement design. And, you know, will that project stay in the Other Kind dice space? Maybe not. Like I said, it's much more suited to one-shots. It chews up characters a lot over time. But as a design exercise and a fun thing to play, I really recommend it to anyone who's thinking about doing design work or is curious. Blaze in the Dark actually was used Other Kind dice for a week or two of early playtesting. We knew it wasn't going to suit the game. It needed to be a long play game with lots of sessions and lots of character and crew development and all that stuff. But as a place to start and kind of see, like, okay, what kind of challenges, consequences, opportunities, and dangers, like, what is kind of the vocabulary of the game and that at that level, it helped in that sense a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting you say all that, because when I hear a game that chews up characters and spits them out, I think of Blades first. Like, that's all the Blades campaigns that I run. But Blades, of course, has resistance to kind of mitigate that and, you know, provide that longevity to it.
Yeah, it does chew up characters too. Not in, like, 3 sessions necessarily. Yeah, it's possible, but it can happen. But But there's an old post on Vincent's blog anyway about this series they ran called Salt River, which was sort of a Western mining town freeform-ish game that they played with their local group of friends. And it used Other Kind dice, but it didn't have a risk sheet. It was just from the momentary fiction. So you would just say, I want to do this, but I might not achieve it. I'm going to pick up a die for that. And I might lose the respect of Rebecca. I'm going to pick up a die for that. Anyone else think of, is there anything else here? And someone might be like, oh, well, Rebecca's dad already hates you. So that's going to escalate with him, probably take a die for Rebecca's dad.
I can almost see a way to make it GM-less there, of like everyone go around and propose a card and just like
that particular group was GM-less.
And amazing.
And the other part of it was that sort of question answering thing. It wasn't about the memories, but in that GM-less or shared GM role thing, somebody would say, I wonder what's happening with your character and Rebecca and Rebecca's dad. I want to go there and see how that's escalating.
Yeah.
And now we have this question, and we're going to resolve that question by trying to achieve a goal and taking risks. And when we do that, we go, okay, cool. Does someone else have a question? Well, I was wondering, you know, the sheriff and the canyon, he's looking for those bandits that went out there. What's going on with them? Okay, let's find out. And it helps you when you have a system that's kind of like needing to be improvised in the moment. Those scene setting questions make it so much easier for you to go, okay, well, now we know this is over. We've resolved the thing our co-GM was curious about. So now let's cut away to something else.
Yeah.
And Siren's able to do that work with its scene based. The chasers are a number of scenes behind you. And they're also locations. You change locations when you change scenes. It kind of mechanically does that work of saying, okay, we're in a new place. There's some question of what's going to happen here. And we're going to resolve it with these goals and dangers. And then we know we're going to move on. And then during those roles, we're going to find out, do the chasers catch up by three scenes or two or whatever? And it's kind of doing that same work, that co-GM work, but it does it more mechanically. So the GM, honestly, you could definitely play Siren GM-less for sure.
Mm.
And just, you know, change the first say to another player or something like that.
Totally.
Yeah.
So I really love this system. I mean, I think Siren is amazing. I've been working on a game that every time I think about other kinds of dice, I'm like, I should try them again in this game. And then I do and they don't work. But like, I like this system so much. I respect it so much. And I also have never seen another game that uses it, which is partly about my age and like what games have had staying power. But also, it does feel like something about other kind dice has had less like broader applicability to games than the sort of classic PBTA formula. And I have an instinct about that, which is the sort of like how much it's chewing up characters in the way that you've described here. But do you have any other thoughts on like why this has never really caught on more?
I'm not really sure. I mean, that is a factor. Characters are very simplistic. There's not a lot of places to go with them. So any kind of game that wants like development and long-term play and stuff is not going to be super well served. There's ways to do it. You could definitely hack it to, you know, maybe you get a different type of harm card when you develop in a certain way. And there's ways to think about that. When Other Kind was first sketched on Vincent's blog, a bunch of people did hack it and make mini games, and there was a little flourishing of stuff. Then Vincent kind of put together Other Kind proper, which is a game about these sort of fae folk dealing with the world of men encroaching on their territory. It ultimately wasn't really, I think, what he wanted it to be. So it's not a product you can get or anything.
Yeah.
You might be able to find a PDF scrolled away on the internet somewhere. But after that, I think that was around 2007, maybe 2008. There was another little flourishing. I wrote a game called Ghost Echo, which is a little two-pager that's on my website that uses Other Kind as its base. Mm-hmm. And it also is like approaching Apocalypse World moves, because Vincent had been sharing early ideas around what the Apocalypse World moves were going to look like. So it kind of straddles those two worlds. It has goals and dangers, but they're connected together in these little move formats. When you do this, you can achieve these goals and you risk these dangers. And, you know, Apocalypse World was just coming into fruition, starting to play test and stuff a year later, I think. So in that flourishing of these mini games, people played them a bunch, and especially on story games, someone was always posting, oh, I've got another kind dice game where you play time travelers, and they just didn't last. Part of it was that people weren't making game products back then, really, in that community anyway. They were making, the game was just a forum post. There wasn't even a PDF or anything. So they had a lot of influence, contributed to the ongoing conversation that led into stuff like PBTA. But yeah, product-wise, Siren is kind of the only one. There's Nathan Pauletta has a game called Annalise, which the foundation of it is Other Kind Dice. It uses some other stuff. You have tokens and these resources you can trade and stuff, but it has a similar kind of root. But that's kind of it.
I got really distracted by the mention of Annalise because I like read it like 6 years ago and haven't heard of it since, and like didn't remember any other kind like influence in it at all. But I'll have to recheck that out. That's interesting.
I mean, once you go back, you'll see it, but it has a bunch of other stuff going on that doesn't make it super obvious. But yeah, I respect this design a lot too. I think it's really elegant. It works great in play. I've always had great sessions with Sairun and Freeform, other kind dice. But yeah, there is something about it that I think when people start building their game around it, they tend to abandon it and move elsewhere. And maybe it is the two things. It could be just as simple as that, that characters get chewed up. And also, it's not super obvious how do you have longer form development. But yeah, I would love to see a whole bunch of other kind games. Maybe a zine of them or something would be, awesome.
Honestly, something I've been obsessed with lately is Aaron King wrote this zine called Reading the Apocalypse, which was just a PBTA move based on a novel that they read that year, independent of any game. And so it's just a bunch of weird, very flavorful PBTA moves. And I feel like you could publish something really similar that's just other kind dice results and then try to, peel through it and be like, oh, I see the whole game out of the infected card that becomes turned, right? You can build the whole game around that yourself. And 36 of those in a zine that are all from different genres and doing weird different things, that'd be a cool product.
Yeah, do Morkborg style, magazine layout. Every spread is a different risk sheet with crazy graphics and thematic stuff. And that could be super cool. There you go, internet. There's a project for you.
Take it. the thing I've been working on is a Firebrands hack where you're a found family in space. And every once in a while you have to go do a job instead of being chill on your spaceship. And I've gone through 30 different systems for what the jobs look like. But one of them was other kind of dice. And I always feel like you ought to be able to make that work of just do a little bit of other kind of dice as a treat. As one of the Firebrands mini games.
I like that idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
That could definitely work. Just as you were describing that, I was picturing a risk sheet, but it's the control console for your ship.
Oh my God.
You have to you have this bucket of bolts and you're what's broken this week? Oh, well, we got to let's put the one in the sensors because they're on the fritz. And
You can see it doing Star Trek with it, right? You can really it's so genre flexible too, I feel like.
Yeah, man, I don't know. I'm getting a little fired up about this now.
It's just so easy. It's so obvious what you're supposed to do. For a full PBTA game, it's also pretty obvious what you're supposed to do, but writing a playbook takes more work than writing a single other kind risk sheet. You can get the whole game done in less than the time it takes you to write the angel, I think that's what feels so inspiring about it to me.
Yeah. I hope when people listen to this, they check it out and maybe start dabbling. Maybe this will launch the other kind dice renaissance that we didn't get in 2004.
Or we did get it. This time it'll be recorded and...
Yeah. It'll be in a place people can find it, hopefully. And
I'll say that this is going to come out right around zine month 2024, and that means now people are finishing those and they can start thinking about their 2025 projects and just throw another kind dice array in there and be good to go.
I have things I have to do on a deadline, and now I just want to when this interview's over, I want to just open up InDesign and start laying out a risk sheet.
Isn't that just being a creative? So much of this is getting cut out at this point, but I have been really trying to embrace whoever said the quote about working on your art should be having an affair. You should be stealing time to work on it. And I have this stuff I need to get done on a deadline, and I have a set aside my normal time for it, but I can't bring myself to work on it at 10 o'clock at night. I have to go cheat on something. I have to go steal away and do my cool little other kind project then.
Yeah, my friend Eric Lewandowski, he always would say that there's always time for a love affair. I don't know if he was quoting someone, but I love that phrase.
John, thanks so much for being here. This was amazing.
Yeah, that was my pleasure. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the show, and it took me a while to figure out what mechanic I want to talk about because there's so many.
Well, listen, come back any season you want to. I
would love to.
Thanks again to John for being here. You can find them on socials at John Harper most of the time, and their games are available at 17design.com and on Itch, among other places. Links in the show notes. This episode was edited by Chris Greenbrier. He did a few this season. Thanks so much, Chris. You can hear him on air on the Blazeball episode last season. As always, you can find me on socials at S. Dunnewald or on the Dice Exploder Discord.
Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.